Welcome to Series 2 of Too Young to Stay In, Too Old to Go Out. I aim to dispel the fusty myths and the apparent prerequisites of old age. My guests and I set out to prove that age is not just a number, but more importantly, a state of mind. Together, we walk you gently through the joy and despair of coming to terms with the golden years, while upgrading ourselves to what we like to call the platinum years. In Series 1, I had guests from all walks of life, including show business folk, musicians, photographer, a local initiatives group, and a networking queen. They all had their own stories to tell, but there was one common theme: the desire to keep improving, keep learning, keep developing. You'll hear that same mixture of guests on this series. The podcast has gained some momentum, and I'm longing for you to hear my new guests and what they have to say as we discuss their philosophy on aging well. I aim to bring you a manifesto for living a longer, healthier, happier life, and what reaching old age signifies to each of our guests. And there is one overriding message: say no to age discrimination.
My guest is Mary Wilson, the British pop and jazz singer, often known as the Neasden Queen of Soul. She first arrived on the scene in the early 80s with her skyscraper beehive hairdo, bizarre sense of fashion, and fully choreographed 12-piece band, the Wilsations. In 1982, Mary's records began entering the charts, and she soon had six hit singles, the biggest being Just What I've Always Wanted and Cry Me a River. She moved to more intimate shows with regular appearances at venues such as Ronnie Scott's, the South Bank, and festivals alongside legends B.B. King and Ray Charles. Mary has also appeared in musical theatre, including Sweet Charity, playing Dusty Springfield in Dusty the Musical, and appearing in her one-woman show, The Love Thing. She's continued to release records and perform. And in 2016, she released her critically acclaimed album, Pop Deluxe, where she breathes new life into the songs of Dusty Springfield, Cilla Black, Petula Clark, and Sandy Shaw. And she's performed her Pop Deluxe show throughout the United Kingdom, and I was lucky enough to see her very recently in London. Mary, thank you very much for joining me on Too Young to Stay In, Too Old to Go Out.
That's my pleasure. Thank you.
And tell me, what does the title mean to you?
The title of the podcast?
The podcast, yes.
I suppose, Jamie Lee Curtis on the Oscars, I think it was, screamed at the camera to bands like Coldplay and Bruce Springsteen, saying, "Why don't you ever do a matinee?" Because she says she doesn't like to go out at night. It's too late. She doesn't want to go to a gig. And I'm a little bit like that. I mean, I'm okay going out and doing my own gigs, but going out to a gig, you know, I'm not keen on standing anymore. You know, so I need to be sort of in a theatre. I want to go and see Daryl Hall, who's going to be playing at Hammersmith Odeon. I refuse to call it Eventim Apollo or whatever it's called. To me, it's Hammy Odeon, you know. But even that, I think, oh, it's a bit big, you know, and you can't park. And so I've become a little bit like that. But if I really want to go and see something, I will. But I'm not as bothered about going out anymore.
I get what you say about not standing, because the first song in my show is actually also called "Too Young to Stay In, Too Old to Go Out," and I do say in one point, I just can't stand for hours anymore if I don't get a seat. My feet get sore. So.
You know, it's just. And I think, you know, I sort of try and embrace it, really. You know, that's the way it is. I'm older now. And also I need my sleep. You know, I need my sleep I've got type 1 diabetes, which I've had for 45 years, but I do need quite a lot of sleep. And that's one of the first things the doctor told me, actually. I was only 22. But he said, you know, you're going to need more sleep than your friends. You know, I remember him saying that to me. And that's... that's always been the case because my body's so busy with, you know, my blood glucose being not completely the same all day long. So that's, you know, it takes up a lot of your energy, doesn't it? So I do need a lot of sleep. And in fact, I went to my friend Ian Shaw's for dinner last Friday. And every time I got up to leave, he said, no, you can't leave yet. You can't leave yet. My daughter was here, who's 26. And she was panicking about where I was. I thought, this is ridiculous. My 26-year-old daughter worrying about where I am. And I didn't get home until 2:45. And it's taken me quite kind of 2 days to get over it. Such a late night. You know, it's not good. But anyway, so that's a very good reply to your first question. Anyway.
Well, thank you. Let's go back in time a bit when you actually started out. I guess it was, must have been exciting for you back then. Hopefully.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was very exciting. You know, it was all part of my master plan, really, you know, being on Top of the Pops and everything.
Right.
You know, and I often say that when I was on Top of the Pops, it was like, yep, this was all part of the plan. I knew I would be on Top of the Pops. But there again, there's loads of people I know who are very talented, but they didn't get to be on Top of the Pops. So, I mean, how come I did? I don't know. It's the stars lining up. It's a lot of things. It's your team, which a lot of people use that now as a term. You know, yeah, my team. I don't mean it in that way. I just mean it's all the people that you're working with that are aiming for the same thing. And I think it's like a collective consciousness. And the more of you that are doing that, the more likely it might be to happen. You know. So, yeah, but it was very exciting traveling the world and, you know, having hit records. It was very different to now, very, very different to now. It's a completely different industry, really. I mean, the market is saturated. Everybody wants to be a singer or a pop star or a whatever. And, you know, I think if you went into a classroom in, say, 1965 or 1970 or even later than that, and said to all of the children, right, who in this classroom wants to be a musician? You'd probably get one person, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas now, you'd probably get 80% of the class putting their hands up. Yes, I want to be a musician. I want to go to music, you know, to BIM or all those places that do the music courses, you know. I think it's because of things like Pop Idol and, but when I was doing it, you know, I mean, I sort of started, I suppose I seriously started about 1980. And there weren't that many of us, you know. And when I look at what was in there weren't that many. There was Annie Lennox, as far as women are concerned, Annie Lennox, me, Toya, you know, Swing Out Sister. I mean, now there's hundreds, you know, there are hundreds of records coming out every week. It's very, very different. And of course, we have social media and that's changed it. Hugely, in some ways, in good ways, because someone who's really talented can open a YouTube channel and say, look at me, I'm great, you know, and doesn't have to wait to get a record deal, but it's very different.
Do you think when you ask that question, you know, who wants to be a musician and that 80% reply, they're really, some of them are not so much thinking about music and what they have to do, they're thinking
about
the celebrity of it, aren't they?
No, they just want to be famous.
Yeah.
You know, they you know, maybe not all of them, but most of them, they just think, oh, great, you know, I'll be famous. And and then there's that awful kind of sad side of people who go on, you know, Pop Idol, X Factor, any of those shows, you know, and they do get picked up. But a year later, they've disappeared. But it's kind of really messed with their head, you know, because they've had it for like 5 minutes and then they've just been dropped, you know. It's not a quick, it can't be a quick fix. You know, you've got to want to be a musician and you've got to become a musician. You know, if all you want is to be famous, that's a different game altogether. And I didn't love that side of it. Some of it I did, but I think you've got to be made of stern stuff to really enjoy the, you've got to have Madonna's kind of genes. You know, which I don't think I have.
Oh, well, that's pretty tough, I should think.
Yeah, I mean, she's fearless, isn't she? And
fearless,
she courts, you know, and always did. But she's made a different stuff than me, you know. And I mean, I'm not saying that all she wanted to be was famous, although she's always said that she did. But I mean, I think she was sort of doing it for all the right reasons. But yeah, it's a funny old world, and it's not normal to be famous, is it? It's not normal to walk out your door and have people screaming at you or following you, or it's a very strange occupation, really. You know,
what training did you have?
Oh, none.
None. Yeah.
If I had any training, I was in the choir at school and I was in a few things at school. When I first went to grammar school, I was, for some reason, our music teacher, Miss Treese, decided that I should play the cello. But that didn't last very long. Because once I discovered, you know, the Bee Gees and David Cassidy and Led Zeppelin and God knows what else, the cello didn't seem very appealing, you know. But my brother's a musician as well, and he's 6 years older than me. So we used to sing, and my parents were very musical, both could sing and everything. And my sister, we'd all sing.
Yeah.
We were like the Von Trapps of Neasden. So, yeah, so my training was singing with my brother, and we'd go through the Beatles catalogue, and we'd sing songs, and we'd say, right, let's do that, and... I want to do the harmony. No, well, let's sing it twice then. Once with me doing the harmony, and then we do it again with you doing the harmony. You know, it was that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And just listening to records, listening to the Hollies. You know, I was always into harmonies. So, you know, the Hollies and bands like that. So that was kind of my training, really, you know. And then later on, when I was having hits, I did see a singing teacher for a little while, but not for very long, really. So I've come completely self-taught, really, you know.
How did you manage to get a 12-piece band together?
Oh, well, that was stupid, really, when I think about it. I mean, it was great, but it was still a bit of a stupid thing to do. I was in the studio with Todd Taylor, who wrote Just What I've Always Wanted, and we were in the studio and I kept saying to him, I want to do gigs. I don't want to just make records. I want to do gigs, you know. And he said, well, you're going to have a really big band to make this kind of sound, because we were doing real Motown-esque stuff. And I just said, oh, all right, then. Well, we'll have a big band. And it just happened, you know. I had two of my old school friends on backing vocals, and there was 13 of us the first two gigs we did, and then we reduced it to 12. And 12 is where it stayed, you know. So you know, when you're doing a gig with John Otway and Wild Willie Barrett on the bill, and you think, well, there's two of them, and they're getting the same money as us, and there's 12 of us, I've made a bit of a mistake here, but not really, because it was great fun, you know. And and that's what made it, really, was the whole choreography and the and our clothes and our attitude, you know.
What attracted you to the Beehive style?
Well, my sister, really. My sister is 8 years older. So in the 60s, she had massive hair and was into Dusty Springfield and wore the eyelashes and everything.
Yeah.
So I kind of looked up to her, and I liked big hair. And I used to watch, you know, there were always films on a Saturday afternoon, like, yeah, with Lana Turner and people like that. And, you know, or Brigitte Bardot or all of that bunch, really. And I just loved the kind of, I loved the big hair and the glamour, everything really from the 50s and 60s. I mean, I also really loved the 70s as well. But, yeah. And I just found that whole look really suited me, you know, because I'm a sort of curvy girl. I'm not, you know, tall and skinny. I'm not short, but, and it, yeah, it just suited me. And I've got influence from my sister and in fact had a couple of her sort of party dresses, which I wore on my record sleeves too, you know.
Right. You performed with people like B.B. King and Ray Charles.
I wasn't on the same, we weren't on stage together. I was just on the same bill, you know, a couple of jazz festivals and stuff, which is thrilling, you know. It was thrilling. I mean, I've shared the stage or been on the same bill. There's lots of really interesting people, you know, and you don't really expect to do something like that. But that was once I'd kind of gone into the jazz world, you know, when I started doing that. So that was, you know, that was quite a long time after the pop.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of watch them because, I mean, if I'm around somebody and they're really, they've got their own particular style, there's things to learn, isn't there? Aren't there really?
Yeah.
I asked dramatically.
Well, you know, I mean, I really learned how to sing once I started doing jazz.
Right.
Playing at Ronnie Scott's, and then I had people like Guy Barker in my band and Simon Hale on piano and, you know, Neil Wilkinson, Ian Thomas, Andy Gangadine on drums, you know, these amazing musicians. And I learned a lot from them. And my agent, who was Ronnie Scott's agent, sent me loads of cassettes in those days of jazz artists, like Clifford Brown, the trumpet player.
Yeah.
And he would say, listen to these guys, because that's, you know, and it was really listening to these instrumentalists and kind of imitating them, you know, because you sort of listen to where they go with the melody when they deviate from the melody a bit, and it's very clever and very moving, and you have to try and find a way of doing that yourself. Although I'm not a scat singer, and I'm not someone who, I don't really deviate from the melody to the point where you've forgotten what the song is. But and I'm not particularly into that either. But it did teach me, and doing all those gigs at Ronnie's, you know, you when you're on stage and you're playing live, you can't hide, you know, unless you're on a massive stage and you've got all the bells and whistles sorting out, keeping you in tune and things like that, because that's what goes on now on these really huge tours. But I've that's not been my experience anyway, and I wouldn't really want it, you know.
Yeah. And you also performed in some musicals. Did you enjoy doing that? Well, I guess you did, if you did it several times.
No, it just kind of happened, really. I mean, Sweet Charity, Phil Wilmot, the director, he wrote me a letter. I mean, see how different things were back then, because there was no email or anything. I mean, when did I do that? Late 80s, was it? God, it's hard to remember. He wrote to me and just said, we're putting on, you know, a fringe production of Sweet Charity, and we'd like you to play Charity. And I either wrote back or I phoned or something. I think I wrote back, and I said, look, I'm a trained actor. I'm not an actor. And if you give me the lead, that could be a massive mistake. But I'll take one of the lesser roles so that I can at least learn, watch and learn, you know, and not piss everybody off by people going, what's this pop star doing? And I did learn. It was tough because I had to do a New York accent. I played the Cheetah Rivera part.
Right.
But
and you have to dance, presumably.
A bit. Yeah. It was all right. I'm not a dancer, but I can do simple steps, you know. And it was absolutely hilarious. That was one of the happiest experience of my life, being in that company. Everyone really got on well. Everyone was lovely to me. I made some great friends. It was excellent. And then I did something called the Chainsaw Manicure at the Etc. Theatre in Camden, which was a two-hander. And that was all dialogue. There was no, you know, it was a lot of dialogue.
And what was that about? It sounds a bit scary.
Oh, it was weird. It was about these two girls living in a flat, and someone moves in. I think they've got a spare room, and they get this guy to move in, and I think he turns up one night in full deep sea diving gear with the flippers on. And I remember him walking on stage doing that. I can't remember entirely the storyline, but it was a sort of black comedy, really. But that was good. And then I did play Dusty, which was much more where I thought, oh, I can do this because it's about a singer, and that's who I am.
Yeah. So for your one woman musical, The Love Thing, then you wrote the songs? You wrote most of them, or all of the songs?
All of the songs. What happened was I'd been with someone for 18 years, and we broke up in 2000 or something like that. And I think it was while I was doing Dusty. And then I made an album soon afterwards called Dolled Up, and one of the reviewers said, this is an album for divorcees, which I thought was very funny. I mean, we weren't married, but 18 years might as well have been, and we had a child, you know. And I thought, And what happened was I gave a copy of the album to Dave Stewart, the Eurythmics Dave Stewart. And he phoned me or emailed me or whatever and said, I've listened to the album and I think you should write a one-woman show with all these songs, you know. And then what happened was we had to write more songs to enhance the storyline in different ways. And that became the next album. So, yeah, I mean, I'm kind of in the process of writing another one because in that one I played a part. So although it was kind of my story, it wasn't really. It was a bit. And then the rest of it was made up. But I'm actually in the process of writing my own one-woman show, which really is my story, you know.
Right. Do you do both the music and the lyrics?
Yeah, I mean, it depends. I'm very good with melodies. So sometimes, I mean, I don't really play anything. I play a bit of guitar, but badly. And I'm trying to force myself to practice piano. But I think, you know, I mean, I end up co-writing them because I need someone to play piano and stuff like that, you know. Yeah. And I wrote most of those with a guy called Adrian York. And in fact, we're writing together now. But the lyric usually comes from me because I've got to sing it. So I've got to relate to that part of it, really. And yeah, I mean, some songs I've written completely on my own. Because I think if you've got melodic ideas and you've got the lyric, you know, you just need the pad that goes underneath, really, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, a friend of mine, she died a couple of years ago, called Ali Willis, and she wrote the theme from Friends, you know, the TV show Friends. She wrote that. She wrote music for The Colour Purple. She wrote Boogie Wonderland, you know, Earth, Wind and Fire. And September, Earth, Wind and Fire. She didn't play anything at all, you know. So I think if it's in your head, it's in your head, you know.
So
I've usually got ideas, you know, but it's quite lonely doing it by yourself. And so I wouldn't want to always do it.
Yes.
You know, the ones I've done completely on my own are few and far between. Usually I get together with Adrian or whoever I might be writing with, you know.
Melody is so important. I know that sounds a rather trite remark, but you do seem to hear so many songs, particularly, funny enough, in musicals, where, well, I suppose they've got some sort of melody, but they're just not memorable. Well, that's my bugbear.
No, well, not lately. Yeah. I think that's very true. I think that's very true. Yeah, and I think it's because they're too formulaic. Mm. You know, they're not different enough, really.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is. But also, don't forget, we had these amazing composers writing songs for things like Oklahoma and Guys and Dolls and, you know, incredible songwriters. Yeah. It was the craft, you know, that's all they did. So, it's not... you don't often see a new musical where you hum the songs on the way home.
No.
Not so much.
Let me ask you a bit about Pop Deluxe. What made you want to record that album?
Oh, well, that came about because I'd played Dusty and loads of people kept saying to me, why don't you do a gig of Dusty songs? Why don't you do a tour of Dusty songs and all that? So I did a gig or two, I think, at Pizza Express Dean Street. I thought, well, I'll try it out, you know. But what I discovered was, as much as I love Dusty, a lot of her songs are ballads. There aren't that many up-tempo songs. And so it was lacking in, you know, you need light and shade. Because I wasn't thinking about recording anything. I was just going to do some shows of her songs. But it was too... There were too many dark moments, and I thought, well, I need more than this. So, excuse me. So my friend Trish Penner said to me, why don't you do an album and do all the songs of the girls that you watched on TV that you listened to that you loved? So I did, and that's how that came about. But, I mean, really, it's not so much about the girls. It's about the songs.
Yeah.
I mean, loads of Burt Bacharach songs on there, for instance. and loads of songs written by Jackie Trent and Tony Hatch. You know, she was a fantastic lyricist. So although they all had the hits with them, it is more about the songs, you know.
You've told us a bit what you're working on at the moment, particularly this new album, but anything else you'd like to do still? You haven't done yet, or just anything else you'd like to do?
I don't know. I mean, sometimes I think, would I like to do another musical? And then I think, nah, it's exhausting. 8 shows a week, you know, and I'm getting older, and I think, well, I don't know if I want to do that again. I guess I feel like I've got so many albums I'd like to make, you know.
Right, yeah.
I'd love to make a Latin American album. I love Latin American music, you know, and I think I'm quite good at singing it.
Oh, yeah, because you had at least one in the show I saw recently.
Yes, I mean, I did Perhaps, I recorded for a TV show called Coupling. And I just, you know, I really like all that, you know, Astrid Gilberto and that kind of thing. I'd love to make an album like that. You know, I'd love to make an album with an orchestra. Yeah. You know, I'm running out of time. It's like, well, I don't know when I'm going to get all that done.
Then,
you know, and there's people I'd like to sing with, probably. You know, I've always wanted to sing with Daryl Hall, you know.
Yeah.
He's one of my favourite singers, you know. In fact, he's the one who's playing at Hammersmith Odeon. In a couple of months, and I'm kind of, and with Todd Rundgren, it's like, ooh, really, can I be bothered to go to Hammersmith? I'll have to get the tube, which is fine, I suppose, but it's big, you know, and packed and smelly. I don't know, I might go.
No, it's not the nicest place to see anything in, it's true. Mind you, it's a damn sight better than it was about 40 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, the last gig I went to there was Mott the Hoople, which was about 15 years ago, I think.
Right.
Not the last gig I went to, the last gig I went to at Hammersmith, you know. I've been to plenty of gigs, yeah.
Finally, I wanted to ask you with, you know, everything you've done and where you are now, is there any particular advice you would now give to your younger self? As you started out?
I think to have more confidence. You know, I'm always amazed, and I think it's even, maybe it's changed a bit, but when you look at American artists, Americans are somehow brought up to be super confident. And you look at people, young artists who go on the David Letterman show or the Jimmy Fallon show and they're interviewed and you think, look at them, look how confident they are, you know, the way they talk about themselves and their work and everything. And British people generally aren't really like that. We're not very good at blowing our own trumpet. Or if we come across too confident, you know, it's not admired, whereas it is in America, you know, just people like Katy Perry, you know, so confident. You know, and I saw an interview with Taylor Swift the other day, you know, and it's like, I mean, she's incredible anyway. She's almost alien-like, isn't she? She's so prolific, such a clever girl. And I sort of look at them and think, God, I wish I'd have been that confident, you know, because I wasn't, much as I may have come across as, I wasn't really, and I wish... I would tell myself to have a bit more belief in myself.
Right.
And that's why when I was referring to Madonna, a massive amount of self-belief. She could not care less what anyone thinks. And I don't think she's ever cared what anyone thinks. And whereas I'm a bit more sensitive. I would say, you know, Mary, be more confident and go steaming in there and don't be... You know, I mean, I'm not shy as such, but there's some kind of shyness about me, which I think I still have anyway. It's probably that.
Well, thank you very much. Anyway, thanks very much for being a guest on this podcast. It's been great talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Too Young to Stay In, Too Old to Go Out. The beauty of podcasts is that you can decide to listen while staying in or going out. I hope you enjoyed the episode, and if you did, please remember to spread the word.
Keep up to date with future podcasts and events by subscribing and adding alerts to whichever platform you are listening on. I'd love to hear your thoughts and suggestions on future topics or guests, so do get in touch.